Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub, a professor of anthropology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'm the host of the channel today. We're going to be talking to Nancy Matina, the author of Uncommon Anthropologists, Gladys Reichard, and Western Native American Culture. Nancy, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So this book is a biography of Gladys Reichard, who is remembered today as a student of Franz Boas and an ethnographer of the Navajo. But in many ways, she's actually not very remembered. There isn't a lot of work that's been done on her, and your book is her first full-length biography covering her. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got interested in her and how you came to write this book?
Sure. The thing that is most unknown about Gladys Reichard, I think, in the anthropological community, is that she was as much of a linguist, a student of Native American languages, as she was an ethnographer. I think she preferred to refer to herself as an ethnologist because back in the day that encompassed the study of, you know, human culture, which included language and cultural anthropology, et cetera. So, for some reason, for many reasons, actually, she was kind of erased from not only the history of American anthropology, but the history of Native American Indian linguistics. And but I happen to have done graduate work in Native American Indian linguistics and got a PhD in that subject from Simon Fraser University in the 90s. And I studied a sister language to the one that she worked on, the Kurdalang Salish language. And she was a constant, her work was a constant reference for mine. And so I knew her name, I knew her linguistic work, but I knew nothing else about her. And when I started many years later casting around for a sabbatical project, I thought of her. I was no longer teaching linguistics. I wasn't really practicing as a Native American linguist anymore, but I did want to do a scholarly project for a sabbatical. And having moved to Arizona from the Northwest, I started looking at people that I could write about, thinking that this would be a good way to kind of bring together various threads of my career as well as my interests. And I came across Gladys Reichard, whose papers happened to be, or a good chunk of her personal papers happened to be in the Museum of Northern Arizona, about 90 minutes north of where I live in Arizona.
You know, you've really done a lot of work in this book. It's very, very closely researched, and the density of quotation too, we can really see you working with primary materials. So it looks like you really were enchanted by the subject, even though the path to this might have been a little bit wayward.
Well, you know, what happened was that I started reading about her, you know, just randomly anytime. I just do a Google search and just, you know, collecting materials. And every account of her, none full length, but every account really depicted a very different person from the last one. I mean, it just, there was no coherence to who this person was, you know, once I got interested in her as a person as well as a scholar. And so I was just really struck by all the mismatches. You know, one author would describe her as, you know, very lonely and unimaginative. And the next would say that she was really submissive to her mentor, Franz Boas, one of her mentors, excuse me. And it just didn't add up, because I knew that the strength of her work in linguistics, in Native American linguistics. But then I was reading about, you know, how sort of dull she was when it came to ethnography. It just didn't add up. So when I decided, and I had enough material to go forward with the book, of course, I had to have kind of a thesis. I mean, it wasn't just going to be, you know, one damn thing after another. I realized that I had to really document everything that I discovered, because it hadn't been done before. Everything else, frankly, was part of a whisper campaign against her, as well as people sort of taking other people's word for who this person was, what kind of work she did, and what her sort of mission in life was. And so I just felt like if I was going to go to the trouble of writing a full-length biography, sort of, as they say, a cradle-to-grave biography, that it better be documented so it rests on something and not just a perpetuation of all the rumors that are out there floating around about her.
Well, I definitely want to talk about that whisper campaign. I think it's so fascinating that someone's life work can be shaped so much by others. But before we do that, let's give pride of place to the established narrative that we now have because of your work. So who was Gladys Reichard, and why should we remember her, and what was remarkable about her?
Well, who she was a woman of what they call Pennsylvania Dutch or Pennsylvania German descent, who was born in eastern Pennsylvania in 1893. Same year as the Columbia Exposition was taking place in Chicago, I might add. She was born in a small slate mining town, a couple hundred, 2,500 people or so, really a village. For some reason, she decided, you know, at an early age, she was going to go to college. She wanted to become a physician like her father. And she ended up at Swarthmore College doing essentially a pre-med course. And then her final semester, her biology professor was talking about some evolutionary ideas and mentioned Franz Boas and his work in anthropology. And it just clicked. And that's what that she was just drawn to that. So she applied to Columbia and she was accepted into the graduate program in anthropology at Columbia. And from then on, basically from 1919 on, she was an anthropologist. And in those days, being an anthropologist meant wasn't completely for field anthropology. She didn't do much with physical anthropology. She certainly didn't do much with archaeology. But she really was the first American woman to focus her doctoral work and then subsequently her career on linguistics, the study of unwritten languages and the systematization of their grammar. So at that point, from 1919 on, she became this incredibly adventurous, accomplished, and well-regarded linguist. She was at the center of the so-called Boasian Circle. And she had along beside her people like Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict, who went on to achieve quite a bit more popular acclaim. But Reichard was right there in the mix with all of them. And she taught at Barnard College for 32 years and was the only faculty member in the anthropology department, which essentially was created by her for her. And then she died in 1955, very well-regarded, lots of friends, amazing accomplishments. She had so many firsts, it's sort of embarrassing to, you know, sort of list all those things. But she was truly a pioneer, a free spirit, loved the outdoors, was funny, as I said, had lots of friends. And then within 5 years of her death, she was just sort of gone. She was gone from the...
So how did she, I think it's interesting for people to remember how anthropology at Barnard got started. So I just want to really highlight that, but You know, when I think if you asked many people sort of who was Boaz's close disciple, they would think of Benedict or maybe Mead. But you show us that Reichard and Boaz really had a kind of connection that was just very, very different from those two. She rented an apartment in his house. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually been to that house. Across. Yeah.
That's cool.
No, I haven't been inside, but because I don't know who lives there now, but I made sort of a pilgrimage to New York City many years ago. And one of the side trips was to cross the river and go see Boaz's old house. And it's still there.
I want the address. I want the address.
Okay. I'll send it to you. Yeah. In any case, so they had, it was just a big house on the right there on the Palisades, and that it's not a mansion or anything. It was just a big, very functional house. And the top floor was an apartment because Boaz and his family were always hosting people from, other scientists from around the world. And at some point, before the Depression, she started renting there so that she drove and he didn't, and she loved to drive. So she'd drive him to work every day, basically. For 15 years she lived there. There were reports that she was there for a year or two, but no, as a matter of fact, she was the family tenant for about 15 years all total.
A lot of people, when they read about Boaz, once they get past sort of the initial stuff about him being sort of opposed to racism and creating American cultural anthropology, which is that story is a little more complicated. A lot of his students don't remember him very fondly. Sapir and Loewy, they describe him as being very demanding and not extremely empathetic, but she really appears to have hit it off with him.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'd say that one of the more intriguing things to me about Reichard's story, of course, I really did fall for her, as others have said about her when they read her letters. She's just a really lively, engaging intellect. It's just really fun to be in her presence. But one of the things that just over and over came through from the research that I did was that the whole story of Boaz and the Boazian circle and all of his, if you want to call them acolytes, he wouldn't, but his students, there's been a real mythology that's built up about him. And what we saw in the late 20th century was a lot of effort by obviously younger anthropologists of that era, really trying to disown Boaz and displace him. And the irony of that is that the whole myth came from his foes, essentially his rivals, who were, many of whom were his students. There was a real kind of desire to topple Boaz as the leader of American anthropology. After all, he'd been sort of at the helm of American anthropology since at the least 1890s. And so by the time, particularly the Mead and Benedict generation came along in the 1920s, there was a very concerted effort to relieve Boaz of his command. And it was that kind of just sort of professional ambition that ended up driving the myth that Boaz was this controlling, domineering, close-minded individual who was just all about power and was not particularly compassionate toward Native peoples or their many ailments that were inflicted on them by dominant society. So there was this whole picture that was built up of him being this really bad guy. And when in the late 20th century, when there was this sort of revulsion against colonialism and, we wanted to rid ourselves, that is to say, those anthropologists wanted to rid themselves of the stigma of having been involved in this exploitation of Native cultures for their own benefit. Boaz was a perfect scapegoat for that. But the fact is, he wasn't a scapegoat for that at all. We owe the entire scientific framework that underlies the civil rights movement and the human rights movement that we take so for granted today, we owe that to Boaz. It was he who said to the anthropologists of the 19th century who were busily making the case for a racial hierarchy using anthropology as the discipline to shore that up. He said to them, you're making the case that that there are these racial hierarchies. And of course, race meant more than just skin color in those days. It had to do with any physical or any difference of appearance or behavior. And you're making the case for to discriminate based on these hierarchies, and you've given us no scientific proof. So here's an idea. Why don't we posit that all people are created equal, that appearance and behavior are due to other factors that are not relevant to understanding, you know, how human society functions. And let's assume that there's a unity there, and then go out and find the evidence to support that. So he essentially flipped the whole racial paradigm on its head, and that freed women and people of color and minority cultures everywhere to consider themselves to be equal until somebody else proved otherwise. And that was crucial. That's crucial to everything that we understand about how society works today.
And, Reichert didn't just know him. I want to talk more about her work, but just to get some of the context down, she was also very close with Elsie Clues Parsons, which is someone who some people might not have heard of, but I think historians recognize as a real major figure who had that same kind of political charge and also was very important to the discipline. Reichert and her were very, very close, right?
Very close, yes. In fact, I would say that because, Boas was extremely busy, and he was also, he had a lot of people to be thinking about. He had so many projects going, and he was very involved with the work of his students and the work of his colleagues, so that, you know, he didn't have a lot of time for chit-chat. And Parsons, who I consider to be Boas's intellectual soulmate, I mean, they were just both completely committed to essentially a social justice agenda using the discipline of anthropology to get there, to move things forward. There was just this sort of woman-to-woman bond between Reichert and Parsons that, you know, that just wasn't possible to have with Boas. I mean, he just had too much going on. And Parsons was also very busy, but she was, 20 years older or so than Reichert. And she was, Parsons was a mentor to Reichert. There's no question about it. And the fact that Parsons didn't have a faculty position, didn't seek one, didn't need one to do the work she wanted to do, meant that it was very, very easy to write her out of the sort of the mythic narrative of the history of anthropology, history of American anthropology. She didn't fit into the academic model through which that that history is traditionally written.
Parsons was independently wealthy, and she wrote her PhD on Gabriel Tarde, who is a social theorist who's sort of come back into vogue in the past 10 years a little bit. And she was a reformer and a progressive, and some of her political tracks on the equality of women read in a very contemporary way. They feel very fresh. And if you read some of her some of the things that I've read are like the sort of ethnographic appendixes to the genealogies that she did. They just read like lovely little novels. They're remarkable little gems hidden away in a lot of these texts that are open access. She really was a remarkable person.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny because while I was doing this research, of course, I was trying to learn a lot about a lot of people. And Parsons, of course, was one of them. And fortunately, there's an excellent biography of her by Desley Deakins. But time and again, I would see in the fairly, current recent literature, anytime Parsons' name was mentioned, it was always Mrs. Parsons, which I found incredible, that in you know, 2012, or that in the 1990s, people are referring to Elsa Clues Parsons, who was this brilliant scholar, sociologist for the first half of her career, a really productive, driven anthropologist and folklorist in the second half of her career, and that she's still being referred to as Mrs. Parsons and being basically billed as a philanthropist above all, which is just ludicrous. The fact that she was able to finance her own scholarship, you know, really has been held against her in a way that doesn't make a lot of sense. And so it leads you to wonder about how is this, you know, history of anthropology built? I mean, what sort of were the premises on which it was built? And then, of course, that leads you to the question of who is it who wrote the history of American anthropology in the 20th century? And that's a question that leads you right back to the students of Franz Boas, who were not sympathetic to his social justice, which I call a humanitarian thrust. I mean, I'd like to come up with a better word, but it strikes me that what Parsons and Boas and Reichardt had in common was this commitment to what I would call humanitarian anthropology. And we've come around back to that, but there was a time through much of the 20th century where we lost the thread of that. And I'm pretty sure I know who's responsible for that.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that, because when I teach my history of anthropology courses, I often point to the post-World War II period as being very different than the interwar period. And so I'm glad that someone who actually studies this thinks that that's right too. But Reichardt was really an insider. She was really much closer to these central figures than people like Mead and Benedict. And I'd love to talk with you more about Parsons, you know, the reaction to her from even the people who took her money. Some people like Kroeber really liked her, and then other people did not. But we do have to talk about Reichardt. So she, like so many other people, did field work in the Southwest. And I knew of her as I study the Pacific. I study Papua New Guinea. So I'm not at all an expert on indigenous people in North America. But I did know about her book, Spider Woman. And that ethnography is a prime example of an ethnography that is sort of alive and vibrant and has a sense of style and humanity, and was written at a time when a lot of people today assume that no ethnographies had that quality. Can you tell me about her fieldwork in the Southwest and that book and how it came to be written and what it's about?
Sure, I'll try. It's hard because the thing I want to say that connects really Parsons and Reichardt, where Spider Woman, the book Spider Woman, is concerned, is something that I once heard Ken Burns say, you know, the documentarian, say about his work on the Roosevelts. You might remember that a few years ago he came out with a very, very long video documentary on the Roosevelts. And what he said was that the thing that caught him most by surprise when he started researching their lives, and this would have been Eleanor and Franklin and then Teddy, the three of them were the focus of this documentary, is what surprised him so much was how modern they were and how sort of current their interests were. And that really stuck with me the whole time I was working on Reichardt's early part of her career. And that meant the time that she was sort of following Parsons' lead to the extent possible. And that's the thing, when you read Spider Woman, is it's just hard to imagine this was written in 1934. I mean, because when you fast forward to the 80s, when you have people questioning about the way ethnographies were written until that point, and that we have, you know, the James Clifford's Writing Culture book with all the essays saying how, gee, you know what, ethnography turns out to be a lot like literature. Maybe it's travel writing, maybe it's memoir, but it's not just ethnography. It's not scientific. Well, you know, there's not a word said about Reichardt's Spider Woman or Reichardt herself in that entire volume. And there were many essays that followed on that same topic of, you know, how subjective is ethnography? Well, in fact, in 1934, Gladys was, Reichard was simply following Parsons' lead and just approaching the writing about other cultures as a writing task. She was quite conscious that she was writing a story of her experience with those people. She was not describing, you know, the Navajo. She was writing about the time she spent with these people. And the book itself, it's really interesting. It starts with the most sort of cinematographic opening, which has not got the hero anthropologist front and center. The hero anthropologist, in fact, doesn't appear for several paragraphs in, and that's in a, you know, poorly lit hogan being, you know, sort of put up as an object of display for the weavers who are deciding whether or not they're going to take her in. So you have this this real anomaly when you read Spider-Woman, if you've read other ethnographies of that time period, with the, you know, all the different headings for, you know, ceremony and religion and childbirth and all these other headings of, you know, they're supposed to bring out what this culture is and what it's like. So Spider-Woman is a story. There's no question about it. And the author is not unclear about that. Reichard is talking to you. I mean, she doesn't name herself. But she is, it's just a, in that sense, it's a kind of memoir, and I've heard people refer to it as that. But I will say that the problem with her, for her in her day, was that when that book came out, it was not considered science. And so it was not widely reviewed. It was considered popular work, and it was, of course, dismissed by other anthropologists on those grounds. And it's taken a long time. The book's been constantly in print. It's now a downloadable, free downloadable book. But the essence is that you are writing along with a sympathetic, living persona who is, you know, just showing you a bit of what she experienced and how she was accepted or rejected or responded to by people that she, who were strangers. I mean, she was a professional stranger, but they made room for her. And what happened, happened. And so it doesn't have maybe the plot that a novel might have, but it has plenty of insight as to, you know, what it means when people with very different worldviews come together and try to be friends.
You know, I think it's so fascinating to imagine what ethnography would be like if people took their lead from Parsons instead of Malinowski.
Yes.
I mean, we'd be in a different world.
Absolutely. Well, as a matter of fact, I mean, I don't mean to get away from Parsons, because there's no question that she is still underappreciated and still we've not sort of circled back to give her the credit for having started this whole idea of dealing with minority peoples, native peoples, as other humans, as equals to us. I mean, that was revolutionary at the time. It's maybe, unfortunately, still has some revolutionary value now. But the fact is that I often wonder how we would have done anthropology. I'll have to leave linguistics aside. I've never had an anthropology course in my life, but I wonder how anthropology would have been done in the late 20th century if the field had continued with the Boasian approach, the sort of social justice approach, the search for the truth, the search for knowledge, not the search for fame and influence, but the search for knowledge with partners from all walks of life. If we hadn't followed that, which of course was the heritage that Reichard pursued, instead gone with the so-called personality, a culture and personality school, basically the Margaret Mead thrust, which was to reignite the love of authority, and that basically every anthropologist to gain power, influence, and prestige needed to assert her authority. And that authority was not to be questioned after a certain point when there'd been enough scholarship done, enough production, and enough PR. And so we went down this path of creating this monument to the authority of the knowing anthropologist instead of staying on the path of trying to find out what are people made of? What did they want? What are they, what's the range of the human imagination? That was Boas's project. That was Parsons' project. And it was Reichardt's project. But instead, we went on the search for fame and ways to fix culture, to fix American society in the wake of the Great War and other disasters.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, I think if people, maybe the Cold War was a blip, and the moment that we're currently in anthropology and Reichardt's life and period, maybe those will turn out to be the normal thing for anthropology as we move forward. Because I think if you look at what contemporary anthropology is doing today, the aspirations of people like Julian Steward or Clyde Cluckholm seem very, very remote and distant. And you mentioned Mead as incarnating that a certain kind of scholarly authority, Cold War authority, which I think is true. I agree with you. But normally, when we think of the uber Cold Warriors, people like Cluckholm come to mind. And he's definitely connected with the Reichardt story because they both worked in the Southwest. And she worked with Navajo people, right?
Right. Well, that was a big chunk of her career. But yeah, of course, as you know from reading the book, Reichardt and Cluckholm weren't at loggerheads, because Cluckholm was a very, very calculating person, and he was very determined to be sort of the male Margaret Mead. I mean, he wanted the prestige, he wanted the attention, and he got it. And he did that, some would say, at the expense of his sort of scholarly code of honor. But the fact is that they tried to work together, but he did everything that is Reichardt and Cluckholm did in the Southwest, in the area that people now refer to as Navajo studies. And but, you know, they were friendly at first because Cluckholm saw that he was kind of a late arrival. So he saw that he could get something from Reichardt in terms of her data and her connections particularly. But ultimately, you know, he was really a player, and he really needed to get Reichardt out of the way so that he could dominate the field. And he was happily joined by many other men, particularly in Navajo studies of that time, in doing that. When the Second World War came along, he just really got a big boost for anybody who wanted to step up and defend nationalism was more than welcome to join in the fray. And Reichardt stepped away from that. Cluckholm stepped into it. They were not friends. I mean, he pretended to be her friend for quite some time. But once the Second World War broke out, then at that point, she was courteous to him, sent him advance copies of her reviews of his work so that he didn't feel ambushed. But he did not return the courtesy one bit. And he did everything he could to derail her career and certainly ruin her reputation. I mean, he was a prime, suspect in the answer to the question, you know, who erased Gladys Reichard? I mean, Clyde Cookcombe was quite determined to have that happen. He didn't live much longer than she did, so he didn't get too much of a chance. But just by ignoring her and, you know, whispering behind her back about her illogic, you know, her being an irrational, illogical person, that's code for woman. He did a lot of damage. But of course, in the end, it was his colleague and not, I don't think, particularly a close friend either, Margaret Mead, who really is the one who did a number on Reichard's memory.
So I definitely want to talk about that. And but I feel like I would be remiss because I don't study Navajo people, and I don't know very much about that area. Can you just, you know, in the book, you describe how author after author really run down Reichard's findings about Navajo. Can you tell me about her own relationship with Navajo people and how that power dynamic played out? Because some anthropologists had very exploitative relationships with the people they did research on, and other ones had very warm relationships, and some of them had warm and exploitative, and some of them had cold and supportive relationships. I mean, what was it, before we turn to what the anthropologist thought about her work on Navajo, what did Navajo people, indigenous people think about her, and how did they respond to her as a researcher?
I think it's pretty clear. I did try to do some interviewing on the Navajo reservation myself. It really wasn't possible because it was just too much time had passed. You know, the grandchildren of the people that Reichard worked with really did not know anything about her. And there were very few alive besides. So I could not get, you know, sort of straight from, you know, living people, you know, what are your memories of, or what is your opinion of even Gladys Reichard or her work. But it does seem clear from the ease with which she moved about in among all, across the entire reservation. I mean, she started working mostly in Arizona, but really Arizona, New Mexico border. But eventually, she got more familiar with Navajo peoples on the western side of the res. But basically, it's hard to believe that she could have gotten the kind of work, data, the information, and the stories that she gathered without a real mutual kind of affection. I mean, she credits being, excuse me, being taught by Red Point, the male head of the Navajo family she lived with in the early 30s. She credits his reputation among other Navajo medicine men with her being allowed to continue to learn about ceremonial practice and lore after his death because of the way social relationships work in Navajo country. And so by his giving her sort of putting his imprimatur on her, then that gave permission, and not only permission, but it made other Navajo medicine men continue to teach her and guide her and explain things to her long after Miguelito's death, Red Point's death. So I also was told something early on in my research by Nancy Pareso, an anthropologist of the Southwest who's sort of recently retired from the University of Arizona. And she did her dissertation in the 70s, if I think I've got that right, on commercial sand painting art by the Navajo. And one of the things that she said, a few times I've talked to her about this, is that as she went around to all of the households on the reservation, maybe not all, but hundreds of households on the Navajo reservation, to inquire about, you know, people who are doing this commercial sand painting art, she said inevitably there would be a copy of Gladys Reichard's Navajo Religion on the bookshelf. It might be the only book in the house, but it was there because those Navajo, those commercial sand painter artists were consulting her work. So that for me leads me to believe that she is welcome there anytime, you know, dead or alive. And the other thing is that, you know, I will say that it's I assume this is true on every reservation, but perhaps more so on the Navajo, that the word anthropologist, the title anthropologist, is not heard with great affection. In fact, I didn't want anthropologists in the title of the book because I definitely wanted people I knew on the reservation to want to read it. But anthropologist has the connotation of somebody who's coming to bug you and exploit you. And Gladys Reichard, I don't think, fell into that category in the conversations I've had with people at Hubble Trading Post, where I've spent a lot of time, which is on the res. I don't think that she elicits the same reaction when you mention her by name. It's tying her to the title anthropologist that gets you in trouble.
And she did quite a lot of field work as well and had a pretty deep commitment to that community. She did not drop in, you know, for a year and then write about it for 30 years after that.
No, you know, she was there every summer. She was in Navajo country for 26 summers and three sabbaticals. Yeah.
And her book describes just how beautiful she thought the countryside was as well.
Yes.
It really sounds like it was the home of her heart.
Absolutely. There's no question. I mean, she was, it's part and parcel. When she died, at the memorial, meeting that was held in her honor, her most distinguished student, Frederica de Laguna, who did not study Navajo, she said she had to sort of argue that we needed to look at Reichard's work in terms of this notion that probably it's a good idea if you're going to devote yourself to studying a people that you like those people. And it seems funny now that you would have to say that, you know, bring that out is like, you know, it's okay to like the people that you're working with. But that tells you what things were like in the first half of the 20th century in anthropology. We were really, you know, people were really consumed with this idea of objectivity, which really meant this sort of value-free, that the researcher herself was not to have any moral or value-based stance towards her research subjects, which is, you know, blows your mind, but because that's not how it is now. But that De Laguna felt it necessary to explain that, you know, Reichard's work was so rich and so good because she actually liked the people that she worked with. That sort of tells you both about Reichard, who was absolutely drawn to people, place, landscape, the cosmology, all of it. She didn't become Navajo, but she appreciated all of it. And that had to be sort of apologized for in some way in 1955 is really kind of revealing, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't explicitly said this, so listeners might not get it, but Spider-Woman is about weaving. And Reichard learned to weave. And her focus was on art. And she treated the product of all of the Navajo people whose work she studied as art, as beautiful, not as as material culture or folklore, which can sometimes have a not a very positive ring.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, she had a history of studying, let's say, indigenous art, but for her, it was always important to remind people that this was self-conscious artistry. This was making beauty for the sake of beauty. And that was also that was off limits in the 30s and the 40s. It just wasn't done because you weren't supposed to have any judgment about these things. You were just, you know, either to describe it or alternatively to theorize about it. But you weren't supposed to have your own kind of emotional reaction to this stuff. But Reichard just, I mean, you can say it, I guess, a number of ways. She just wasn't able to like turn that off. You know, she came to people with her full self, and in turn, she got people's full selves back. And as far as Spider-Woman, woman and the plot line that she went there to learn to weave, she did in fact go there to learn to weave, but that was, in her own words, a kind of ruse because she really wanted to learn the language. And there were no written grammars in English of Navajo at the time. Sapir really never published any of the work that he did. And So she thought, you know, she had gone to Germany right after grad school, and she didn't speak German when she got there, but she did by the time she left. So she had learned a second language, and she saw no reason why she couldn't do that with Navajo, even though she was, you know, well outside of the the best time of life to be learning a second language. But anyway, she decided that if she was going to learn Navajo, she'd need to have some sort of focal point for it. So she determined to learn to weave, and she was handy herself in the domestic arts, you might say. But she also was very interested from the start in getting close to a family that would eventually allow her to learn ceremonial arts. And so there's it's a three-pronged motive for going to live with the Navajo family in the early 30s. And that was to learn to weave as a way to learn the language, so that the language would allow her to make, get entree to the Navajo ceremonial life, which of course involves the mythology as well.
And she supported a young man who I guess apparently is very famous. I feel bad I've not heard of him, as a Navajo artist. And he came to New York, and she helped him get by. So she was interested in extending these relationships back to where she was living as well.
Absolutely. There are many others that other young Native people that she helped get into college, essentially. You're referring to Adolph Bitney, whose name is he's now known as A.D. Dodge. His sort of second half of his life, he was a painter of some renown. But she was absolutely convinced that education was the key to everything, and for everybody. So when she met young, curious, people who were, wanted to assimilate, I suppose you'd say, but who wanted to do more than stay on their reservation and, suffer with all of their family and peers. She did everything she could to send them off to college and mentor them. It didn't pan out most of the time, but there's no question that in that day and age, that was unheard of. And she has not gotten very much credit for that, which of course I'd hope to change.
She also mentored quite a lot of women at Barnard. You have a discussion of all of the people who went through her class, and I'm trying to find it now in the book, but since I have the author here, maybe I can just ask you. You mentioned De Laguna, but there are many other people who we've heard of today who we don't think of as Gladys Reichard students, but they were.
Absolutely. As part of the erasure, I mean, really on every front, I was able to document relationships, letters, classes taken, classes given by Reichard literally, in the case of undergraduates, hundreds, because her anthropology classes, once they got started, she started teaching at Barnard in 1923. And as I said, she was the only person in the anthro department. And in fact, the anthro department didn't exist before she took the position. So in that sense, she founded the department. It was the first anthropology department in a women's college in the nation, by the way. But yeah, every year she'd have 135 students in her year-long survey course, anthropological survey course. And so she had an ability to reach women, college women, in the hundreds every single year. And then, of course, part of her Barnard College gig from the very beginning was that Boaz made sure that she was invited to teach in the Columbia Graduate Department. That's also a little known fact. So that she actually taught in seminars and various courses at Columbia from the start of her career in 1923, teaching career in 1923. So the thing is that she did not, it wasn't like today where you sort of get your name as a dissertation advisor on the front page of the dissertation, So she didn't get sort of recorded as a teacher at Columbia, as a dissertation advisor or committee member, but she was in contact with all of these women, many of whom she gave jobs at Barnard as teaching assistant or administrative assistant, anything to sort of keep them going, because she was very invested in having other women come up behind her, so to speak.
Do you think she taught Zora Hurston? Could she have been Zora Hurston?
Oh, she did.
Sort of
no,
first teacher?
No, she was. She was. And I had letters between Reichardt and Boas that discussed Hurston. And there was just a lot of stuff I wasn't able to leave in the book. My original manuscript was over 400,000 words. And so just to give you a guide, the current book is about 120,000. So I told a colleague that one winter I spent unwriting my book because I did not realize that, you know, what 400,000 words meant, you know, as to a publisher.
And what did she, do you remember what she said about Hurston? I'm asking because she's so central to anthropology right now.
Right. Well, so Zora Neale Hurston was a student at Barnard, and that's of course where Reichardt taught her. And being that Reichardt and Boas were, you know, so often in a kind of, you know, friendly cahoots, the correspondence I've seen is just basically Reichardt saying to Boas, so, you know, where are you going to, you know, where's the money for Zora going to come from? Or, you know, what can I do to help Zora, you know, get this grant or make this field arrangement? So it was just the typical kind of, you know, mentory stuff you do, you know, when you're, you've got, you know, a great student. I mean, you just try to facilitate their progress. But anything beside that in terms of the actual communication within a classroom, I don't know. But they definitely were both pulling for her. And there's letters that show that.
Oh, that's great. I'd love to see. You should take some of those extra 300,000 words and just turn them into a couple of short, you know, those old George Stocking articles where it's just the correspondence with some paragraphs wrapped around it.
Right.
You should do one of those. I'd love to see, you know, sort of more of that origin story. So
yeah, there's a lot of it. She was at the center of everything. So anybody that you can think of from that era and even their descendants, you know, there's going to be a Reichardt line in there, some, you know, from either in Reichardt's letters or in their letters. I did not go hog wild and try to go to all these archives where, you know, people besides Reichardt had letters that might refer to her. But I'm sure if one did, there would just be this mountain of correspondence that points back to Reichardt again and again as being, you know, someone who rooted for them and tried to help them launch their careers.
Well, so we've talked about this in the course of this interview that, you know, she was so central and yet is now so forgotten. And we talked a little bit about Cluckholm and Mead. Can you talk a little bit more about what happened, how it was that she was forgotten? We talked about the way in which Cluckholm, when he sort of didn't need her anymore, mm-hmm. Was no longer sympathetic to her. Mm-hmm. And you describe Sapir's hostility to her in great length in this book. It's a most recent writing that I've read in the history of anthropology shows Sapir in a very unflattering light. So I was not very surprised about that. But mm-hmm. Cluckholm and Mead and Benedict both come off in this book in ways, especially Mead and Benedict, in ways that many people would not be familiar with. I think many people imagine Benedict as Boaz's anointed one and mm-hmm. the preserver of a, you know, what they said back in the 20s and the 30s as a feminine rather than a masculine sensibility in anthropology, and a woman who was unfairly picked on by Linton and other people who replaced her. But your take on Mead Benedict, Sapir Cluckholm, it's quite a bit different than that.
Yes, that gave me a lot of pause as I was writing this book. As I said, I'm not an anthropologist. I don't have the credentials for that. I'm just a writer, but someone who was involved, still to a certain extent am still, but was involved in the study of North American Indian languages. And so I just was really, I had to really fight being cowed by the reputation of both Benedict, well, all of them, Benedict, Mead, Sapir, Cluckholm, not so much because I think he has, I mean, you see sites to him a lot, but I don't think that he has the sort of the popular following that the other three do or have earned. But I felt like I was really swimming upstream. But the facts were what they were. And I read numerous biographies of Meade and of Benedict, and sometimes one of both at the same time, plus a lot of their correspondence. I did not, you know, go to their archives and check out all their letters, but there were enough published letters, because I always wanted to focus on words from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And it just, again and again, it came back to the fact that Benedict and Meade had a really personal grudge against Reichard, and it was a one-way street. Reichard had no reason to think ill of either one of them. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that she was quite friendly and supportive. But for some reason, I think I know what the reason is, but
what was the reason, Nancy?
Well, essentially, and I didn't discuss this in the book, I think that Benedict and Meade were had a lot of class resentment. Gladys didn't talk right. You know, she was happy. She was perfectly comfortable with a little Pennsylvania Dutch or Pennsylvania German twang and usage in her dialect. She didn't dress right. She didn't come from the kind of, you know, plummy Hudson Valley background that Meade and Benedict did. They resented her from the get-go. And the fact that she was so successful, I mean, time and again, her work was recognized and rewarded, and she was promoted, and she was, you know, she had all these research opportunities, and she just kept churning it out. And it was absolutely maddening to both Benedict and Meade. And I mean, those two, Benedict and Meade, were very different people, but obviously they formed a super close bond. And, you know, the fact is that Meade was the kind of personality type, and I hate to say this because I'm much more interested in character than personality, but as it turned out, Meade was, when she started kind of losing the support of her fellow anthropologists and becoming this media sensation with popular audiences, she took it upon herself to declare herself a historian of American anthropology. And that's all fine and well. I mean, obviously, you know, someone within the field can take that position. But the problem is that she did not use any of the sort of checks and balances that historians are meant to have. So that when she writes the history of any given event in the first half of the 20th century in American anthropology, she's winging it. She's just telling the story the way she wants to. It's not corroborated. And what's worse is that after she wrote all of these materials, many of them were in support of Ruth Benedict and trying to just kind of memorialize her and lionize her career, then the next generation of scholars, particularly women, of course, but not exclusively, came along and they simply took Meade's word for it. And by not doing due diligence and going back and getting corroborating evidence, interviewing people who were not Meade's followers or Sapir's followers, Meade's version of the history, won the day. And so what we have is we have this mythic narrative of the 20th century American anthropology, essentially written by Margaret Meade and then echoed throughout the end of the 20th century and into the 21st. I mean, as recently, I think it's 2017, we had a book come out called The Boasians, which is precisely in the sort of mythic model. It lays out the pantheon of the Boasian circle, precisely as Meade would have wanted it, so that you don't have Parsons as being the most feminizing figure in the Boasian circle. Instead, you have Benedict. It doesn't make sense when you step away from that mythic narrative and start bringing in evidence and documents from other perspectives. And that, in that sense, Reichard's story is a lens through which we can re-examine the whole history of American anthropology in the 20th century. And I think perhaps we're ready to do that. I mean, I think you're right when you said earlier that today's anthropologists are much more advocates for and social justice warriors, you might say, for the groups that they work with and study and learn from than they were at mid-century, 20th century. And so we've kind of skipped over this, if you will, Cold War era, and come back to our senses. And but I will say that I think that it's very much the case that it was Meade's fame and authority and credibility on which so much was built about the history of anthropology that it made it very easy for the Parsons and the Reichards and some others of the world, even Frederica de Laguna, who lived into the 21st century, do not have the place in American anthropology's pantheon, so to speak, that Meade and Benedict do. And we don't have to delete them, but we need to enrich our notion of who contributed to anthropology and still save some time for answering the question, what's anthropology good for? Mm. Because I think that's really the question that Boas asked at the end of the 19th century and that Parsons and Reichard were completely committed to answering with Boas's phrase, that anthropology is good for to help us commit to the struggle for freedom from prejudice. And that doesn't just pertain to anthropology, it pertains to all scholarship.
Mm. And it's not really a left or a right opinion.
No.
I think it's a pretty basic commitment.
Right.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. That's a fantastic way to move this interview into its final stage. A lot of important words there. So you've now finished the Reichard book and it's out and people are reading it. Can you tell me what you're working on now?
I'd love to. Yes. I mean, it's taken me a while to kind of Reichard just sort of consumed my life for so many years. I mean, she was a regular guest at our dinner table. And so I've had to move away from that. Still obviously much admire her, but now she's kind of a retired friend. And instead I'm focusing on another project that I hope will keep me in touch with my Navajo friends. And that is, I'm writing a biography of the person that you mentioned earlier, Adolf Bitney, who was one of Reichard's many linguistic informants, a co-author, in fact, of a linguistic paper, who then, after the Second World War, came back to the Rez and became a painter of some renown. And his name now is A.D. Dodge. And just as I was winding down the Reichard biography, I discovered that in 2011, some of his daughter had put A.D. Dodge's papers at the Beinecke Rare Books Library at Yale. And I just went to visit that collection in January. Fortunately, I didn't catch the coronavirus, but I was there for a week. And he's a fascinating character who's it's not so much that he went unrecognized in this case, but he was he had some shady dealings that kind of made people turn away from him. He died penniless, sort of course. But as a matter of fact, I can see now that he is a classic example of an indigenous person, particularly Navajo, but any indigenous person who's caught in what I think Mary Louise Pratt calls a contact zone. And so he's between he lived his life from 1912 to 1992 in this kind of speech community in which he was expected to perform in a certain way. And he wanted to perform in the Navajo way. And he was just caught in the middle, but produced some very beautiful art, but also produced a lot of writing, which was basically crazy. But I think that the story there is going to be that he was essentially parodying what he had learned from people like Reichard, but most particularly Clyde Kluckhohn, who sort of put on airs and said, you know, this is how it is in my culture. And it makes for some fantastically interesting linguistic analysis of the sort of interlanguage that A.D. Dodge acquired and deployed in the last half of his life, trying to get the dominant culture to listen to him.
Wow. It sounds like a really, really interesting project. And I love the thematic connections with the Reichard as well. So I look forward to seeing it. And thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Alex.